Iran's leader tells the visiting Sultan of Oman that regional countries should beware of the Israeli regime's divisive policies. No end in sight to the Israeli violence in the West Bank. Regime forces kill more Palestinians in the occupied territories. And Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez calls for a snap election a day after his Socialist Party suffers defeat in local and regional polls. Welcome to World News, coming to you out of our headquarters right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to Iran this hour, where the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says all-out expansion of ties with Oman will benefit both countries. Ayatollah Khamenei says Tehran and Muscat should continue their negotiations with seriousness to get tangible results that lead to expanded relations. The leader made the comment in a meeting with the visiting Sultan of Oman, Haitham bin Tariq. Ayatollah Khamenei also underlined the significance of increased cooperation between Iran and Oman, seeing how they share what he called the very important Strait of Hormuz. Well, the leader also warned about the risk posed by Israel in the region, saying the regime and its supporters seek discord among regional countries. Ayatollah Khamenei also hailed the Iranian government's efforts to improve relations with regional countries, including Saudi Arabia. He noted that Iran is also open to the restoration of ties with Egypt. Earlier, during the meeting, the Sultan of Oman said Egypt was willing to restore diplomatic ties with Iran. He also said Muscat seeks closer cooperation with neighboring countries, especially Iran.
Tehran is once again the destination of yet another high-profile visit by head of state of one of Iran's leading neighbors. The Sultan of Oman, Haitham bin Tariq Al Said, leading a high-ranking delegation, arrived in the Iranian capital on Sunday. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi officially welcomed the Omani leader. The two leaders then held private discussions and signed cooperation documents in a number of fields, including economy, investment, and energy. Prior to his meeting with the Iranian president, the Omani Sultan held a meeting with Iran's Vice President Mohammad Mukhbir. Referring to close political ties between Iran and Oman, Mukhbir said the two countries should increase their economic and trade ties to a level that could match their political relations. Sultan Haitham Al Said's entourage to Tehran includes Omani Foreign Minister Sayyid Baz bin Hamad Al Busaidi, who met with his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdollahian. Following their meeting, the two officials held a joint press conference where they briefed reporters on the agreements reached by the two sides.
The documents, which focus on cooperation in the fields of energy, investment, free zones, as well as in the areas of industry.
Iran's foreign minister added that other issues were also discussed by the two leaders, namely the transit of goods, the Ashgabat Agreement, as well as quadrilateral transit deal between Iran, Oman, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. He said closer cooperation among regional countries was also emphasized during negotiations between the two leaders. The Omani foreign minister, for his part, noted that the two sides reached good agreements in a bid to further enhance their age-old relations.
Well, the Omani Sultan's visit of Iran comes as Muscat has for many years played a leading role in putting an end to hostility, both on a regional and international levels. Now, with Oman's mediation efforts to end such hostility on one side and regional determination to boost diplomatic relations on the other, it seems that countries in the West Asia region are becoming integrated in the face of the unilateral world.
The visit by Sultan of Oman Haitham bin Tariq Al Said to Iran comes at the official invitation of President Ebrahim Raisi. The invitation was extended as part of President Raisi's policy of deepening ties with countries in the region. The two-day trip marks a significant milestone in ties between the two regional allies. Officials from both countries have said the trip will open new avenues for closer diplomatic cooperation, increased dialogue, and engagement at the highest levels. As far as the economic potential between the two countries is concerned, Iran and Oman are seeking better opportunities to develop their relations. chairman of the Iranian side in the Omani-Iranian Joint Business Council, Jamal Razzaghi, says Iran aspires for increasing the size of the exchange of trade with Oman to $5 billion. This is possible as there are great opportunities for trade between the two countries. Iran does not view Oman as an economic market, but as a vital strategic partner. The improvement of trade relations has the potential to expand to other areas as well. Iran's ambassador to Oman, Ali Najafi Khoshroudi, says Sultan Haytham al-Said's visit to Tehran will foster an unprecedented level of partnership and cooperation between the two nations. Apart from the economic aspect of the trip, the Omani Sultan's visit to the Islamic Republic is of high significance for the development of multilateral diplomatic relations and a strengthening of regional integration. Prior to his Iran trip, Sultan Haytham al-Said paid an official visit to Egypt, where Egyptian officials were cited as saying that Cairo and Tehran are expected to normalize ties as part of a process mediated by Oman. Regarding the Saudi Arabia-Iran deal, it was Oman that mediated negotiations for 2 years. Oman has also been the chief architect of normalization of relations between Syria and the Arab League. Mediating talks between Saudi Arabia and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement was also another turning point in the history of the Persian Gulf Arab state. In a broader aspect, Oman has for decades been an interlocutor in interactions between Tehran and the West. The country has mediated the release of several foreign citizens and dual nationals. Now with Muscat and Tehran trying to deepen their relations in numerous fields, including political and economic, it seems that regional and international developments are moving toward a multipolar world, something that the collective West has left no stone unturned not to let that happen.
Said Mohammed Madandi is a university professor and political analyst. He puts into context the Omani Sultan's visit to Iran.
Iranian-Omani relations have always been good, and cooperation has always existed at very different levels, both political and economic ties. And Oman wants to become a hub for business as well, and Iran is an ideal partner. But I think after the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the changes that are taking place across West Asia and the Persian Gulf, the Saudis rethinking their ties with Syria, negotiating with Yemen, and the potential for the formation of a government in Lebanon, along with other changes that we see between countries in the Persian Gulf region, small countries that have been under the sway of Saudi Arabia. These changes together, I think, bring about a new era for our region. And Oman, having this very good relationship with Iran, stands to benefit a lot from these changes.
Iran says a recent security agreement it signed with Iraq facilitates cooperation in all fields. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Akbar Ahmadiyan, made the announcement during a meeting with his Iraqi counterpart in Tehran. He called the agreement a roadmap for establishing security at the borders, stressing the need for the precise implementation of its stipulations. Tehran expects Baghdad to guarantee border security based on the agreement and to put an end to the presence of anti-Iran elements on Iraqi soil. For his part, Qasem al-Urouji stressed that Iraq's commitment to the recent agreement and said the Iraqi government and its national security body is determined to interact with Iran in all fields. Two Palestinians succumbed to injuries after being shot by Israeli forces in raids in the occupied West Bank. One of the Palestinians lost his life after he was critically injured in an incursion in the city of Jenin. The raid triggered confrontation with locals where 7 others were also wounded. Well, the other Palestinian succumbed to his injuries sustained in an Israeli raid in Al-Khalil 2 days earlier. Earlier today, regime forces also carried out a separate raid in a village near Ramallah. They shot and injured 2 more Palestinians there. Now, the regime has intensified its crackdown across the occupied territories in recent months. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks in the West Bank alone this year. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to give us more details about the latest Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank.
After the incursion to Jenin has ended, the Palestinian 37-year-old Palestinian Ashraf Ibrahim succumbed to his injury. Palestinian paramedics say that Ashraf Ibrahim was shot in the abdomen and the chest. Then he succumbed to his injuries. Ashraf Ibrahim, 37-year-old from Jenin, was an officer in the Palestinian security forces, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. During the operation, six other Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that has been under fire with Palestinian fighters. Hurled explosive devices towards the Israeli forces in raiding Jenin city, and that the Israeli troops had confiscated a number of Palestinian arms and weapons, as well as other military equipment in the city of Jenin. Israeli military also said that six other Palestinians had been arrested in other areas of the occupied West Bank, and they claim that those who were detained, not in Jenin, in other areas of the occupied West Bank, are involved in anti-Israeli operations, that they had took part in shooting towards Israeli settlers and Israeli forces.
Well, the Spanish Prime Minister has called for snap election after a Socialist Party lost regional and local polls to the opposition Popular Party. Pedro Sanchez said in a televised message that his decision was to dissolve parliament and call for general election on July the 23rd. He says the Spanish people need to clarify their demands. With 31% of the votes, the right-wing Popular Party has made significant gains in six regions that had been under the ruling Socialist Party's control. Well, the date is set for late July, 5 months ahead of the original election that was due to be held. Well, the Russian Defense Ministry spokesman says his country's forces have hit Ukrainian air bases, destroying all their targets.
Tonight, Russian military carried out a group strike on the enemy's airfields with high-precision long-range air missiles. The aim of the strike was reached. All assigned objects were destroyed. As a result of the strike, battle headquarters and radar stations were hit, as well as aviation equipment and ammo and weapons depots.
The attacks have been part of a new wave of Russian airstrikes. Ukraine says it has downed all the Russian missiles fired on the country in a second wave of attacks on Monday. The air raids followed hours after overnight missile and drone strikes and was the 16th on Kiev this month. Ukraine has recently been armed with more Western weapons. The Ukrainian military says an attack on Odessa port has caused a fire and damaged infrastructure. Moscow has intensified missile and drone strikes on Kiev this month after a lull of nearly 2 months targeting military facilities and supplies. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kiev with more advanced weapons, including F-16 fighter jets. Now to Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wins re-election in Sunday's runoff vote, extending his rule into the third decade. With over 99% of ballot boxes open, Erdogan garnered more than 52% of the votes. His rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, received nearly 48%, trailing Erdogan by more than 2 million votes. Now, the country's Supreme Election Council says the uncounted ballots will not change the results. After he was declared the winner, Erdogan addressed a crowd of his supporters outside of the presidential palace in the capital, Ankara. He called on Turks to unite in favor of the country's national goals.
It's time to unite and unify around our national goals and national dreams, leaving aside all discussions and disputes regarding the election period.
Erdogan also says the election is Turkey's most important in the modern era, adding that the entire nation is the winner. Opposition leader Kılıçdaroğlu has not explicitly conceded defeat. He says the election was the most unfair in recent years, and Erdogan's party mobilized all the means of the state against him. However, he thanked people who voted for him. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Economic divide.
When it comes to banks, most people are mainly concerned with a couple of things. Can I get a loan? And the ability to withdraw their money. Well, in the U.S., these two have become serious issues for depositors, since U.S. bank failures are mounting. And while there has been a bank run, the U.S. government still refuses to acknowledge that there's a banking problem in that country. Hi, I'm Kavit Tafwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program: 4 bank closures in the U.S., many more are predicted. Tumbling bank shares as a result. One reason, rising interest rates. Next, taking a look at the banking crisis. Well, deposits are falling. Bank runs are happening on a more frequent basis. That is a major problem when you have runs, because then the money is being pulled out. And then the cost of keeping customers, that's on the rise. And for the banks are unable to maintain that cost. Next, the health of the U.S. economy as a whole. Rising interest rates, you have inflation, you have the banking crisis. That is obviously two signs that are not good. And then you have a debt ceiling, which may be solved, but still it points to a dark economic downturn for the U.S.
The U.S. is facing an economic crisis. Just weeks ago, J.P. Morgan Chase took over the troubled U.S. bank First Republic in a deal brokered by regulators. First Republic had been under pressure since last month, when the collapse of 2 other U.S. lenders sparked fears about the state of the banking system. The failure of the San Francisco-based First Republic is the second largest in U.S. history and the third in the country since March. It was ranked as the 14th largest lender in the U.S. at the end of last year. Problems in the banking sector surfaced in the U.S. earlier last month when Silicon Valley Bank, which was the country's 16th largest lender, collapsed in the biggest failure of a U.S. bank since 2008. That was followed 2 days later by the failure of New York's Signature Bank. Meanwhile, the U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that over 700 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Authorities say rising interest rates are creating significant unrealized losses in investment securities and, in some cases, depressing tangible equity.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The U.S. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has insisted that the U.S. banking system is sound and resilient, but many have expressed concerns that the U.S. banking crisis is not over and a much worse financial crisis is coming.
Time now for our social media post. First up, U.S. banks sitting on $1.7 trillion in unrealized losses. These losses are not yet reflected on the balance sheets. The study shows that many banks' assets lost 10% of their value this year due to rising interest rates. The current state of the U.S. banking system is fragile and could be at risk of a crisis. This could have a ripple effect on the financial system as a whole. Next, we went to a website, and this is about the amount of money that's being withdrawn. April 17, 2023, depositors pulled nearly $60 billion from 3 U.S. banks as Apple raises pressure. Next, we go to another date, April 1st, where this website said depositors yanked another $126 billion from U.S. banks. where it said that the depositors to have drained another $126 billion from U.S. banks during the week ending March 22nd. And this was sourced from the new Federal Reserve data. This time, the outflow came from the nation's largest institutions. And finally, three failed U.S. banks had one thing in common. It's called the KPMG. Big Four auditors work for SVB, Signature Bank, and First Republic comes under scrutiny in the aftermath of their collapse. Let's break this down based on this entry. The trio of bank failures since March has cast a pall over this KPMG's lucrative business as the largest auditor of the U.S. banking sector. In all three cases, KPMG gave the bank's financial statements a clean bill of health as recently as the end of February. So that's obviously not a good sign if the regulator is doing that. All right, let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. First, we have Paul Craig Roberts. He's a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury who joins us. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to Economic Divide. When we take a look at what has happened, you have emergency meetings that are taking place. You have central banks offering credit lifelines. You have tumbling bank shares. These are all alarm bells that should be going off. Well, the question is, why are U.S. banks in trouble? I mean, it is also said that aside from the ones that have failed, many more are on the horizon.
Yes, the banks are in trouble. And the reason is, or the visible reason, the most visible reason, is the rise in interest rates. And the reason that the rise in interest rates cause the bank trouble is that for 10 years, a decade, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, kept the interest rates very, very low, practically zero. And in real terms, the rates were negative. And so the assets that banks purchased for investments, such as U.S. Treasury bonds, these assets are now depreciated by the rise in interest rates. When interest rates rises, the price of existing bonds falls. So the situation for the banks is that their assets have all been pushed down in value by the rise in interest rates, but their liabilities have not. So their liabilities now exceed their assets, and the banks are technically insolvent.
Wow, not a good condition that these banks are in based on that explanation by Paul Craig Roberts. Next up is our other guest, John Diamond. He joins us. He's the director of the Center for Public Finance at Rice University's Baker Institute. John Diamond, welcome to Economic Divide. As to why this is happening now, that's what we're trying to get at, and hopefully you can answer us. But based on the research we've done, the turmoil is part of the fallout after central banks, including in the U.S. and in the U.K., raised interest rates sharply. That's what our guest also said, where it started last year. And they did that to try to dampen down the rising prices. But is that the only reason, these rising interest rates, for the banks to fail?
I mean, that is the reason. These banks had invested in what they considered to be a very safe asset, a U.S. Treasury. They did not foresee such a large rise in interest rates. So they didn't buy, or they didn't manage the risk, the interest rate risk that's associated with those bonds correctly. Once the Fed started raising rates, that insurance became prohibitively expensive, or at least was expensive enough that they didn't get it right away. And so, yeah, the Fed raising interest rates was the major factor. Obviously, had the banks, you know, manage the risk a little better, then they wouldn't be facing such significant losses.
Time now for our Info News section of the program, where we have four news items with an economic flavor that we present to you. First up, something that's happening in the U.S., which is of grave concern, and that's U.S. bankruptcies. Big firms are filing for bankruptcy left and right. And it's just the beginning based on the source that we picked for this. The filings have laid bare just how exposed highly indebted firms are. And this comes in the wake of, guess what, interest rate hikes. It said the data from Moody's and S&P Global suggests the pain could just be getting underway and could last all this year. All right, this is a great achievement that's happening between Iran and Russia in terms of an achievement, and it regards a railway. Moscow and Tehran signed a key rail deal. The new route will help diversify international trade flows. The construction involves a rail line between the Iranian cities of Rasht and then Astara. The cost, it comes in at $1.6 billion. Also, along the lines of Russia-Iran trade, this would be about the economy of both countries to benefit from this. Russia's second largest bank, VTB, opened a branch here in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this, in a sense, also points to de-dollarization of both countries. Now, this concerns China and West Asia in terms of the trade that's happening between the two, which is important in terms of the data. In the year 2021, trade between the countries of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, or the GCC, and then China surpassed that of the United States and Europe for the first time. And the source of that particular piece of data was the IMF, and attributed this to Beijing's pro-growth policies and West Asian region ambitious economic transformation programs. So that's that just shows how Asia as a whole and its trade relations with countries in West Asia, where we are, is progressing at a rapid pace. Next up, something that's happened in Turkey. And, of course, it's not about the elections, but it's election-related vis-a-vis its economy. Now, we know that the runoff is going to take place. When you watch this program, it may have taken place already. But in terms of Turkey's stock index, it fell after the election stalemate that happened, which it was rallying because many thought that Erdogan would actually lose. But in terms of the bets that were against Erdogan, well, obviously that failed, which shows that you cannot count Erdogan out. Many are predicting now that he will actually win in the runoff. Well, those were the, I guess, news with the economic flavor that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to banks, the depositors or customers don't care about anything except for one issue. Can they get their money out of the bank whenever they want? In other words, this is the question that we pose. Are U.S. banks safe overall? That is the focus of this in-depth section. Okay, first, let's get down to some basic facts about banking. Now, surprisingly, many don't realize that when it comes to their money and when it is deposited in a bank, well, a legal fact is that the money deposited there is actually a loan that you make to your bank for which you earn interest. The bank actually takes your money and loans it to others and makes money based upon the differential in interest rates as well as fees. Many don't know that. Then we go to this fact. If the bank is on shaky financial ground, and of course your money is sitting in that bank and it goes into things like bad loans, well, this ultimately becomes the problem of the creditor. That means you, the individual. But how is that possible, you may ask? You may say, well, it's my money and I should be able to withdraw it at any time. Yet, that is hardly the case. I want to tell you why. Here comes another term, which, again, a majority are not familiar with, particularly in the U.S. What is it called? It's called a bail-in. Definition and how it affects the rights of a depositor. Well, bail-in is another form where banks and financial institutions are rescued, where the responsibility is transferred from the taxpayers, in the case of a bailout, to the depositors. And that's you in this case, okay? Now, here's the important part. A bail-in will not actually add to the government's deficit. How, you may ask? Well, it will allow banks and financial institutions at risk of failing to take some of your deposits to bail themselves out. Did you get that? Very good. Next, how will a bail-in then likely happen? Well, with the U.S. economy heading towards some negative factors, such as a possible recession or the inflation, which is at an all-time high, and then the housing market, which is in a bubble, well, uncertainties are looming over the head of Americans. And one clear sign of all of this, U.S. banks going bankrupt as they have been. Okay, let's get more on this. Let me bring back our guest, Paul Craig Roberts, who's a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, rejoins us. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome back. Given the negative news on U.S. banks and the bank failures that we have been covering, we're looking at around $200 billion in bank runs that's happened so far. Is the U.S. going to face an even larger bank run, do you think? And would that lead to many bank closures? And what can the depositors do to stop that happening or preventing them from withdrawing their money, do you think?
For two reasons, depositors are withdrawing their money from the banks. Well, the way the banks have to provide the money to the depositors is to sell the assets. But the assets are depreciated, so they're not getting the amount of money that they need. And so they are all in a mess. And I think it will continue because I suspect that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are encouraging bank failure in order that there can be more concentration in the banking system. In other words, when a bank gets in trouble, then the large banks, the banks too big to fail, they purchase that bank. And so we see growing monopolization of the banking system.
Wow, that's a very interesting point that he's making there. Let's find out what John Diamond thinks. We'll bring him back in, director of the Center for Public Finance at Rice University's Baker Institute. John Diamond, welcome back. When you take a look at the health of the U.S. economy, we'd like to find out from you how it's doing. You have a banking crisis, you have the debt ceiling problem, which probably is going to get solved, but nevertheless, even if we don't see the total breakdown in trust when it comes to things like banking deposits that are being made, we could still see how the economy is not doing well, taking a look at the bank closures, especially in things like maybe unwillingness to lend at this point. How severe an impact do these closures have on the U.S. economy?
So it's going to have a big impact. We've already seen banks pulling back on their ability or willingness to lend credit. Moving forward, how tight credit gets in the U.S. is going to depend on what happens with future interest rates, as well as what happens with this debt ceiling crisis. If the U.S. Congress and the president come to an agreement and we get this crisis behind us relatively soon, then I think we will avoid any large problems. We will just face a relatively small cost in terms of there's been a hesitancy to lend with this uncertainty on the horizon. If we push this right up to the deadline, those costs get larger the closer we get to that deadline, as credit, the cost of credit default swaps and other contracts are having to be unwound behind the scenes. If we go past the deadline without a deal, then all bets are off and we could return to something similar to a 2008 style crisis in which the whole system starts to unravel.
The banking crisis is not the only problem the U.S. is facing. As the national debt has soared, the U.S. Treasury Department has had to borrow more money to pay for government spending. The legislative curb on this borrowing is known as the debt ceiling. When the Treasury Department spends the maximum amount authorized under the ceiling, Congress must vote to suspend or raise the limit on borrowing. economists are warning of dire consequences, including a default, if Congress cannot reach an agreement on the ceiling. In January 2023, the total national debt and the debt ceiling both stood at $31.4 trillion. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues. Economists warn that a lengthy default could send the American economy into a deep recession with soaring unemployment while destabilizing a global financial system built on U.S. bonds. Investors are bracing for impact, although any debt non-payment would likely be temporary. An analysis by Biden's economic advisors has warned that even a brief default would cost the U.S. economy 500,000 jobs at a minimum. They believe a protracted default would send GDP plunging by 6%, with the loss of tens of thousands of businesses and some 8.3 million jobs when it's all over, almost as many as during the 2008 financial crisis.
A default would threaten the gains that we've worked so hard to make over the past few years in our pandemic recovery, and it would spark a global downturn that would set us back much further. It would also risk undermining U.S. global economic leadership and raise questions about our ability to defend our national security interests.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Mahdi Abbasyan. U.S. bank failures have raised the alarm on a number of fronts, both within and outside the U.S. In the case of SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, the former chief executive said he was unaware that the bank was in trouble when he sold stock weeks before it failed. SVB's downfall was triggered by holdings of long-term treasuries losing value as interest rates rose quickly, a risk the bank had not hedged. The bank tried to cover the loss by raising capital, but in announcing the transaction helped fuel a bank run.
We know your banks were fatally mismanaged. The next obvious question is why? Why did you let things get this bad? Why did you ignore admonitions from regulators?
Becker, you made a really stupid bet that went bad, didn't you?
Senator?
And the taxpayers of America had to pick up the tab for your stupidity, didn't they?
Senator, there were a series of events, unprecedented events that occurred that led us to where we are today.
No, this wasn't unprecedented. This was bone deep, down to the marrow, stupid.
When it comes to First Republic, the former chief executive, Michael Roeffler, blamed the bank's collapse on the contagion from the failures of other regional banks and said regulators did not express concerns regarding the bank's strategy, liquidity, or management performance. A total of over $100 billion in deposits were withdrawn from the bank over the course of weeks in response to an industry-wide panic about the soundness of regional banks.
First Republic's financial position and strategy were regularly reviewed by our regulators, the California DFPI and the FDIC.
His comments on the speed of the collapse, Silicon Valley and Signature Banks were quite interesting.
No one at First Republic could have predicted the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature, the speed at which it happened, or the impact it had on the banking industry. Instead of dealing with temporary decreased earnings due to interest rate pressures, First Republic was contaminated overnight by the contagion that spread from the unprecedented failures of those banks.
That does it for this Quick Take section. Please send us your comments or questions. We would really appreciate it.
So, is there a banking crisis in the U.S.? I mean, on the one hand, let me come up actually with you with this question. If there was a banking crisis, do you think U.S. officials and authorities would actually make that announcement that there is one, which would risk more of a bank run? I mean, the same applies to its economy. At the heart of the U.S. economy, there is a heartbeat, but it's a weak one, from colossal debt to weak economic growth. And of course, you then have runaway inflation. They're trying to control it, but it's been a difficult task. We leave it up to you to judge whether the U.S. economy is doing well as a whole. And of course, the banking problem, whether there is one or not. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to us, and we hope you liked it. From Mikhail Vitaly and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil fa. Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we wanted to discuss and have a look at the concept of supplication from the point of view of the verses of the Holy Quran as well as the other traditions. Now, Ibn Faris, in his Mu'jam, under the title of Supplication, says, supplication means attracting one's attention using words. Raghib also has written in the section Mufradat that supplication is the same as vocative speech, except that in vocative speech we use vocative articles, ya or aya. Now, if we take the absolute supplication as a kind of genius, and if we consider the kinds of supplication such as Genesis supplication, tongue supplication, or heart supplication, the Creator's supplication or people's supplication as fasl or a chapter, we may adjoin the absolute supplication with one of the features that I mentioned, and we call it supplication. Among the most prevalent definitions in sciences is to mention the characteristics and those main features of an item. This is because the realization of the essence and the truth behind things are not accessible even by all the scientists, since they unanimously have believed that the recognition of truth of existence is somehow relative. So it's different based upon the different points of views of the people. All what science has revealed is but a very small portion of the secrets of the creation. These secrets still remain behind a curtain of ambiguity. The introduction of supplication using its effects has frequently been observed. We have seen and we read in some traditions that supplication is a believer's weapon. It is the foundation of religion. In some other traditions, it is said that the heavenly light on the earth is supplication, and it changes one's fate. It will cause the disasters to be away, and finally, supplication is introduced as a relation between God and his servants. And these such effects and actually main characteristics are mentioned in different traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, and they are referred to as the effects of supplication. And as we have seen earlier, the best kind of definition is the one which somehow distinguishes the essence of something. Through this definition, we may separate our question from ambiguity and find its borders. A good example is mentioned in the Holy Quran, where God discloses the nature of man. The verse says, وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنْ سُلَالَةٍ مِنْ طِينٍ. Certainly, we have created man of an extract of clay. ثُمَّ جَعَلْنَاهُ نُطْفَةً فِي قَرَارٍ مَكِينٍ. Then we made him a small seed in a firm resting place. ثُمَّ خَلَقْنَا النُطْفَةَ عَلَقَةً فَخَلَقْنَا الْعَلَقَةَ مُضْغَةً. Then we made the seed a clot, and then we made the clot a lump of flesh. فَخَلَقْنَا الْمُضْغَةَ عِظَامًا فَكَسَوْنَا الْعِظَامَ لَحْمًا. Then we made in the lump of flesh bones, and we clothed the bones with flesh. ثُمَّ أَنْشَأْنَاهُ خَلْقًا آخر. Then we caused it to grow into another creation. In this holy verse, dear listeners, as you can see, it is shown that the evolution of man is clearly, as the verse says, in explaining supplication, this last definition is prevalent in the words of great people. And this was the example.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
It has been mentioned in Al-Mizan that supplication originates from the heart and it is uttered by the tongue, one's nature. It is not the movement of the tongue, however, and it is the nature. So this, dear listeners, simply means that man recognizes this truth deep inside himself. Man clearly knows its values. One of the significant features of this definition is that it will include Genesis application as well. None of the definitions we referred to earlier are inclusive as this one. Allama Tabatabai says, "Thus, you will observe that Allah responds to supplications that are not uttered by our tongues." Allah says in the Holy Quran, وَآتَاكُم مِّن كُلِّ مَا سَأَلْتُمُوهُ وَإِن تَعُدُّوا نِعْمَةَ اللَّهِ لَا تُحْسُوهَا. And He gives you of all that you ask Him. And if you count Allah's favor, you will not be able to number them. This is what the Almighty Allah says in this verse of the Holy Quran. Now, elsewhere, it is said in the Holy Quran, يَسْأَلُهُ مَن فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. All those who are in the heavens and the earth ask of Him. And this clearly shows that Allah's favors are not countable. People ask God of what is in the heavens and on the earth, and what has been stated by this verse makes our definition clear. Now, I assume perhaps the best thing we may get out of the definition that we mentioned of supplication is this. The best and most inclusive definition for supplication is asking, in its broad and common sense, merely asking. It will then include all these definitions, even the Genesis definition. The specific features of supplication under different situations depend on special motives which a user has in mind. But this broad sense of asking is the definition of supplication. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.